from the PNG, the Monitoring Group.
Oh, okay. I just want to get your name for the, because we've got a list of names. Are you from the
group?
From the DA? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. More.
Emma More.
There we go. Good.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, brother. My name is Calvin.
My name is
Calvin.
Sure.
Sure. Are you sitting here?
Yeah.
Listen, this MP3, ne? If I put it here, ne?
Would I be able to pick up?
Or should I put it nearer?
Okay.
On the disc? Mustn't be near the speaker. Yeah, I did ask him, I thought maybe I can put it here. But let me help, let me take it away, no?
They still want to know what's happening, Mantuli, with the Christ. I see Mantuli, not Christ, I still talking about that, and Mike and Emma, they're still involved. Are you finished, both groups? Oh, we're ready. Okay. Let's morning, member. Let me welcome you to this meeting. Today we're meeting HPCSA. I'm not sure where is she now? She was there. Oh, maybe let's wait for her. While we're waiting for her. I'm sure she's going to be coming. Members, I was thinking that in the African National Congress, where I come from, whenever somebody has got something that is affecting him or her at home, like a bereavement or somebody who's sick, they usually send us SMSs, condolences, and I thought that was enough, but now looking at the fact that we're a committee of bigger than, more than ANC only, I thought maybe as a committee we needed to have some sort of policy as to what do we do in the committee when one of us has either lost somebody or somebody is sick. So maybe it's not something that we need to discuss today. We'll find time and discuss it when we have got time. But for now, we know that Honorable Mike Waters had a problem. The mother got sick and she became paralyzed. She was in hospital. We thought we needed to do something as a committee for her. I'm just saying this one. This is the first time that we are doing it. For those who have had challenges before, we apologize that we didn't do something, but now we need to try and formulate a policy as a committee. But I'll give over to Viola to tell us what the committee has done towards that problem. Viola?
Hi. Morning, honorable members. We have cards and flowers for the mother of Mr. Waters. Thanks.
So you can stand up, Mike.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Che. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
So give this to my mother. I'll take them up tomorrow.
Thanks, Mike. And I'm told that Umama Mswele, Honorable Mswele, is not here with us because her child is very sick at hospital. She's not here because her child is very sick. So probably we'll sit and decide what we're going to do. I've got a good secretary here who usually suggests what needs to be done. Okay, members, today we call two groups of people. We call it deans of Faculty of Health Sciences, and we call HPCSA. We thought those we could combine them because they are probably doing one and the same thing. But unfortunately, the deans have apologized. They said it was a short notice. So we're going to give them another date, but they'll be coming so that they can tell us. There are certain things that are worrying, that we want to know more as to what's going on in that particular area. But much as they have apologized. We have got the HPSA, CSA with us, presented by acting CEO, acting registrar and CEO. That is Umama Marelia. So we'll give over to you so that you could tell us what HPSA is doing. We know there are certain things that are very much challenging in our South African situation. I think some people have heard that in Northwest there's been a doctor who has been treating people differently at this time and age. I think most of the members have heard about that. So these are the things that we want to know. But over and above that, we don't think we've got enough professionals to handle our health institutions, despite the fact that some of them are doing certain things that need to be looked into by the HPSA. So we'll allow you to tell us what's going on. And after you tell us what is going on, probably we'll interact with you and ask you questions as to how the institution is working. We'll give over to you. Is the machine not working? No, let's give you time. Give you time. Okay, you can close your...
And members, thank you very much for inviting us here to come and explain to you who we are and what it is that we do at the HPCSA. Firstly, on behalf of my team, I would like to apologize that I'm not very well represented due to the short notice that we were invited to come and address you today. I was not able to assemble the whole team due to prior engagements. For example, a member of my team, who perhaps you are more familiar with, Advocate Boikanya, who answered a number of your questions beforehand, regretfully had to be present at the CCMA today. And my head of PR called in very ill last night, so she was not able to accompany me. So while we undertake what I'm called here to do today, I hope I will be able to adequately address all your questions or issues that you will be raising here today. Nevertheless, I am currently acting in the position of Registrar and CEO of the HPCSA. I'm sure the older members will be familiar with our old and valued Registrar, Advocate Mkhize, who is sorely missed for his wisdom within the HPCSA that is so aptly have left. And unfortunately or fortunately, he now has another legal activity, I'm sure, another area within our government to get the benefit of his wide and vast experience in the regulatory framework. We were requested to talk about who we are, the services that we actually offer up into the healthcare environment area, what our operations consist of, and why do doctors need to indeed be registered in a regulatory framework. And there were areas of our service delivery that I felt it was necessary to inform the members of. So the way I'm going to undertake the presentation is going to be, we'll talk a bit about our services, we'll cover the operations, and then we'll look at our system. We'll talk about why we needed to move onto a new platform, a fair amount more about our registration department, our legal department and our legal processes, and indeed we will touch on the chairperson's doctors who want to undertake their own activities within our regulatory framework and indeed put our population at risk. Then we'll talk a lot about the professional boards. I was not aware that the deans were going to be also present here. Therefore, I might move a fair amount off the topic that is how it's been projected there, as I think I would need to address some of your concerns regarding issues that the chairperson raised, such as the number of healthcare professionals that we have, and also the standard and quality of care that these professionals indeed are able to give to our population. If you can start straight with the services at the HCCHA, we are a statutory body that has been established in terms of the Health Professions Act of Act Number 56 of 1974, which was recently amended last year in August. What is our main aim? We are here to protect the public and guide approximately 180,000 practitioners that are currently registered on our register. We are founded for the protection and guidance of patients and the welfare and educational standards, etc., of healthcare practitioners. What are we there for? We are committed to promoting the health of the South African population. We determine the standards of professional education and training, and we set and maintain fair standards of professional practice. What is the mandate of the HPCSA? We are here as a regulatory body to regulate the health profession in certain aspects that are pertaining to the registration of the professional, their education and training, professional conduct and their ethical behaviour. We need to ensure continuous professional development, which is CPD, and we need to foster compliance within these healthcare standards. How do we undertake and how do we go about doing it? Registration with the HPCSA is a prerequisite for professional practice. Practitioners are legally, by the Act, required to keep all personal details up to date. An annual fee is payable by practitioners, and failure to pay this fee could result in them being erased from the register. The HPCSA is entirely autonomous. In stating its autonomy, we need to indicate that we receive no grants or subsidies from government, the Treasury, or any other source. The HPCSA is entirely funded by these annual fees that are paid by the professional. Very important in terms of running a regulatory framework and ensuring that our mandate is indeed achieved is corporate governance needs to be adhered from top down, bottom up, throughout the framework. It is indeed a top priority and it is evident in our principles and the values under which we operate. Corporate governance serves as an everyday guide to all levels within the organisation and it is filtered through in terms of our operations. As the new requirements of the Kingsley Report, we've made great strides as a regulator in the following areas in terms of our internal and external audits. Our requirements are met and exceeded in all respects. In terms of King 3, an environmental footprint is extremely important in ensuring the sustainability. We're moving from a paper-based to an electronic system has been our contribution in terms of that. How are we socially relevant within the framework that we work in? We need to be socially responsible, and we do that by being actively involved in our local community. There is complete transparency in our financial dealings, with very clear policies that guide us in terms of everything that we do. And indeed, policies and procedures underpin the way in our finances are managed within the regulatory body. If I could continue with corporate governance, an important IT has become quite a strategic factor within the to ensure the running of the operations of the HPCSA. And their strategic role has also been highlighted with the implementation of our new Oracle system. With 180,000 currently on the register, and indeed up to 1 million, or if not more, records of practitioners over the last 40 years, records and data are indeed our strong point, and therefore the records and data need to be managed securely and effectively. The implementation of Oracle was necessary for our department to ensure an integrated approach, and our department should not operate in silos. This new system will result in operational efficiency and business continuity and sustainability of our business. The implementation of Oracle demanded a very high cash outflow and investment from the HPCSA coffers. So we felt that we need to come and address the committee in terms of where we are placing our finances and what are we hoping to achieve long term, and the sustainability of the move towards implementing a new system. What was the rationale for Oracle? We were sitting with a very aged IT system, which would crash from time to time, which we were not able to have secure data. Secure data in terms of sustainability of our records was a very important aspect. So there was no way out for us but to move to a more stable base for this data. Various systems were investigated to support our current needs, but one does not look, when we're looking at a huge cash investment, we do not look at just the current needs. We need to project and see what will the future growth of the practitioners, the healthcare practitioners in our country be, and how will we, as a regulator, be poised to meet the demand and to meet the need of supporting that regulation framework going forward. Therefore, we required an integrated system which could host in the interaction of the regulatory body, the HPCSA, and our main or some of our external stakeholders, which is the Department of Health, VHS, the Board of Healthcare Funders, and SAQUA, who would we work with very closely in terms of our accreditation process. The Oracle system was implemented in November of 2009. To ensure that we could support the data that we currently had, our old system ran concurrently with it for a period of 4 months to ensure the validation of the data and the efficiency in the implementation. We did experience some initial teething problems with the system, which resulted in our annual fee reminders and our practicing cards being sent to practitioners that. What did we do about it? We needed to be proactive to ensure that the population embraced our new system, as well as the practitioners over and above us, who needed to have a huge change management intervention to ensure that our staff were adequately equipped. So to inform the population that we serve, an SMS and an email campaign was launched to inform practitioners of this delay. We then get on to the next section, which is our registration. As I indicated earlier, it is incumbent upon every healthcare professional to be registered with the HPCSA before they touch a member of the public. This ensures the safety of the population, as well as we need to be sure that the standards of the healthcare professionals who are engaging with our population is indeed what we are very sure of, who it is out there and what it is that they are doing. And by registering letting them know who they are and what standards that they would have complied to be out there as efficient practitioners. The registration of healthcare practitioners is a prerequisite for professional practice. There's a legal requirement which is indicated within the Act, ensuring that or requiring from every practitioner that they keep their personal details current. The failure to comply with keeping their addresses details updated could lead to erasure in terms of the Act. Practicing without a current registration, which means an annual registration, constitutes a criminal offence. This would be in terms of Section 39 of the Health Professions Act of 1974. Registration is dependent on compliance. When we speak of compliance, it means that practitioners need to comply with all the criteria. This means it includes a valid qualification, and in certain instances, for certain professions, it includes an examination that is set by our professional board. Practitioners often request and ask us, why is there a need for us to register? We need to indicate that the concern of a professional status to the practitioner, inclusive of the right to practice the profession that he or she is qualified for. That is what registration confers upon the healthcare practitioner. The assurance that no unqualified person may practice in these professions, and the practitioners that are on the register, their credibility as to the competency of that practitioner, and indeed that practitioner, we know that if they are registered, they may command a reward for the services that they deliver to our population. There are various types of registration in terms of the Act. You will have a student registration. From a student registration, you then move to an intern. This is just a generic screen. In terms of the various professions, there are different requirements dependent on the various professions that are hosted with us. Community service would be required by some of the first professions, and then the practitioner moves into independent practice. There are other categories in which practitioners may be registered. In some cases, there might be a restriction within the registration, which would mean they are registered only to deliver services within the education arena, or they could be postgraduates, or they could want to volunteer their services through the various NGOs, etc. After completing the requirements of each of the registration categories as indicated above, the onus is on the individual to formally apply for registration into the next category. It is not automatic. At this stage, we need to see what actually happens in terms of our services and our operations at the agency as well. Applications come in through to us. They can either be hand-delivered, they could come in through registered mail, or they could come in through the ordinary so-called snail mail, or they could be couriered through to us. I spoke a bit earlier on in connection with the electronic, the move towards the Oracle system, which would mean that we would be almost entirely electronic. Everything comes into the HPCSA's mail room. This is the start of our electronic process, where every document is date stamped. It's so-called initiated at this point, scanned and entered into our workflow. It goes in through to the various departments, either registration, or if it is a complaint that has been received by us, it will be channeled into the legal department, through the professional board, or the other departments for just general mail. I'm going to start with the registration department, and we'll, in the slides to come, we'll handle the other two a little more intensively. one of the previous slides. Registration will demand that all the criteria for registration has to be met. Therefore, the application by the practitioner has to be compliant. If the registration documentation is indeed compliant, together with all the necessary criteria, qualifications, and whatever additional supplementary documentation would be required for that specific profession, it would be considered a compliant application, and the practitioner would be registered within a 21 to 28 day of working day of receipt of that application. If not, this is when all the problems start at the HPCSA in terms of the service delivery that can be rendered, meaning that the practitioners do not give us the correct information, supply the correct qualifications to ensure that all the criteria have been met, their application will be considered non-compliant. Communication gets sent to the practitioner stating that your application is non-compliant and this is what is lacking and still needs to be furnished to us. That application is then filed until the practitioner responds with the correct documentation to ensure that they can be adequately registered within the body. At this stage, we have 38% of the applications of practitioners coming to us as being non-compliant. Within the registration department, what does non-compliant actually mean? It means that non-compliant documents are filed in our huge records department until the practitioner actually supplies us with whatever documentation was lacking in the first place. I want to explain to the committee the type of challenges that we have to face as a regulator with very limited resources as we receive no funding. The challenges that are faced by us once we have documents that are non-compliant. One of the main issues that I felt I needed to highlight to you was that if a practitioner's address is not updated, then any communication then sent to them returns to us because of their contact being incorrect. This results in delays in registering practitioners. What are the consequences of a practitioner's registration being delayed? It effectively means that they cannot work. They are not allowed to touch the population out there if they are not registered. As I've indicated, the consequence is, would be delays in registering. What does that actually do in terms of our service delivery to the practitioners out there? It creates an unnecessary burden on our call centre, who is indeed understaffed in terms of the numbers of practitioners that we have to service. There are unnecessary costs incurred to the HPCSA, because if you're aware of the postal system, where you have returned to send a mail, you pay to receive that mail back. And in terms of the Act, we have to keep a full record of when mail was sent to the practitioner, because we send out registered mail to the practitioners to ensure that they receive it. When we receive it back, we have to pay to receive that mail back to ensure that that letter gets put on file as proof that we did indeed engage with them to indicate to them that their application was incomplete. Another issue that I think that the committee would need to be brought abreast of, and it has become quite important in terms of the shortage which was mentioned by the chairperson earlier on, is what happens in terms of foreign qualified. Are they just allowed to come in and just start practicing because they have so-called qualifications? Indeed not. And that is what our role as a regulator is to ensure that even foreign qualified practitioners have to adhere to a standard and a criteria for them to practice within the healthcare environment in South Africa. So, for new applicants who are not South Africans, a letter of endorsement from the Department of Health before applying to us for registration. It has to come from the Department of Health. The Department of Health currently does not encourage recruitment or citizens from the developing countries. We have a list of countries whereby we do not encourage utilizing practitioners from those countries that have been forwarded to us from the Department of Health. These practitioners are firstly registered in our public sector. That is where the most need is, and therefore they come in to service the needs of the South African population in the public sector. And they must comply with minimum requirements. They are registered in public service, and only on successful completion of registered intern training program, that is for new applicants, are they then allowed to be registered. In terms of internship in South Africa for foreign qualified practitioners, it's dependent on employment as an intern by the Department of Health. We do not have jurisdiction over the employment of professionals. It is therefore, if you have not completed an accredited intern training program, you will not qualify for registration with the HPCSA, unless you apply for internship allocation with a secure written job offer that has come from the DOH. There are special circumstances, and they are treated solely on the discretion of the board, whereby those applications come in, they are screened by the board. The qualifications of those practitioners are scrutinized. They will then be assessed by the board, and they may be exempted by the board in terms of undertaking the exam process. I will be going through that going down the line. You will actually have an opportunity to see what the process actually involves. What is indeed the criteria for independent practice as a foreign qualified? Recently, the regulation changed from the Department of Health. It used to be that foreign qualified practitioners would need to come into our country and serve in public service only for a period of 5 years. This was recently changed, not by us, by the Department of Health, and we will still monitor, track these practitioners, but this is the new regulation. They will come into our country, they will serve in public service for a minimum probationary period of 1 year. Within that year, they will be assessed, and 2 reports will be submitted after every 6 months, which would be signed by the clinical manager of the hospital in which they are practicing. They will then apply to the board and sit the final university exit examination that would be conducted by a recognized university. When I go through the next slide, you will see that there's an examination track and there's a non-examination track, which is clearly outlined the process that they will undergo before they are allowed into independent practice within South Africa. If agreed by the board, they pass the final university exit examination and only then register in independent practice. There are 2 ways for application, which I'll go through now, as indicated earlier, the examination track and the non-examination track. I first need to really lay emphasis on the fact that this process is entirely managed by the Department of Health. It is not an HPCSA process. It is managed by a section of the DOH, which is called the Foreign Workforce Management Group. The only time that we then look at the practitioner is when we have that letter of endorsement. Now, the process is that this practitioner will be registered for public service. If they are on the non-examination track, this is the process that I will outline. If they are on the examination track, this is the process that they will go through. On the non-examination track, they will enter as a medical practitioner and they will be registered on our register to serve within public service as a specialist for 1 year. They will first register as an MP, then they cannot come directly and be a specialist within the environment. So if they meet the criteria after the 6 month and the 12 month assessment, they then may apply for independent practice. If they have attained South African citizenship or permanent residence, they would need to prove all of that in the application to us. This is not our process, it now becomes an immigration criteria that is aligned to the process. If they do not meet the criteria, they would need to repeat the process again to re-register for the year. They will have a 3-year time limit if they would like to specialize, irrespective of their citizenship or permanent residence. If they are on the examination track and they are already qualified specialists, they will come in as a qualified specialist. However, they will register as a medical practitioner within the public service for the 1 year probation. If they comply with the accreditation criteria, they then may register as a specialist. And thereafter, within the year's period, they may go through for independent practice if they have passed the College of Medicine's examination. I just want to go back that if any of these steps are not attained, they have the right to annually reapply. The important aspects are the 6 month to 1 year probation with the report that I mentioned on the previous slide, and they would need to comply with, I'm sorry for the typo there, it's immigration and not immigration. I felt it was important for the members to actually have an indication of the type of numbers and the professions where the bulk of the registrations lie within the HPCSA. I'm sorry that yours is not in colour, but a little clearer up here, where you can see the way our registers have grown within a 5-year period. And I've given just one example of emergency care workers, where in 2005 we had 30,087 emergency care practitioners on our register. It's almost doubled to 54,054 now currently in 2010. I'm going to highlight the names of all these boards on another slide, but suffice to say that the EMB is Emergency Care Workers, and MDB, Medical and Dental Board, where your medical practitioners, your GPs, and your dentists are. Those are the bulk of the actual numbers that are registered. That's your 50,000 mark, and we've exceeded that with the emergency care workers, and we are just slightly under on our medical doctors and dentists. In terms of our mandate, it is the HPCSA that need to regulate the activities of the medical practitioners. We have an intensive legal process in place, and we've answered a number of parliamentary questions over the last few months regarding the various activities of the legal department in the way in which we are trying to ensure that professionals out there maintain their ethical behavior and what it is that we undertake with them to ensure professional conduct. Just to note that there's been an increase within the legal complaints. We were looking at 2,310 complaints that we received in the 2008-09 period to 2,703 complaints for the 2019 period. I will show you the way in which we undertake the legal process, the professional conduct, and the activities of the Office of the Ombudsman. This year, for the 2019 period, 491 cases were referred and resolved by the Ombudsman's Office within our legal framework. The matters that were finalized by our Committee of Preliminary Inquiry were in the 2007-08 period, 652. In the 2008-09 period, 719, and 2019 period, 631. This drop that you see here is indicated because we beefed up the role and the activities, and also the regulation was amended. So many more cases were able to go through to the Ombudsman for a quick, simple conciliation type of resolution. How do we actually undertake the professional conduct at the HPCSA? What is done, how is it done, and how do we get to the statistics that you saw on the previous page? A complaint is received. As I indicated, it's now an electronic methodology whereby once the complaint is received, electronically it's scanned, etc., and then it moves down into our legal department. Where do these complaints come from? They come from anyone in the public, or it could be another practitioner who's observed the unethical behavior of their peer, and therefore they report. As I indicated on the earlier slide, once the complaint is received by the legal department then sorts the complaint, looks at those which they feel that they could be resolved in a conciliatory manner or by the ombudsman, which might not necessarily need to go through our full process. If the ombudsman is able to resolve the matter is deemed as resolved. If not, the matter, for example, if you sit with your practitioner and the complainant, and the complainant feels that despite the proposal made by the ombudsman for a simple resolution, the complainant feels that justice is not being served and they are dissatisfied with the outcome of the ombudsman, they still have the right to forward that directly back to the legal department, whereby they will go through the Committee of Preliminary Inquiry and then to professional conduct if necessary. I'm going to start with the Committee of Preliminary Inquiry. The previous slide gave the indication of how many cases we resolve at the preliminary of prelim inquiry stage. Remembering that in some cases matters go from there still to the professional conduct and formal hearing. Once the legal department has received the complaint, we then request, remember, if the complaint comes from the public, it will be a full explanation together with supporting documents or whatever they would like to support their complaint. We then indicate to the complainant, we acknowledge receipt and say, thank you very much for your complaint. This is the process that will be undertaken. And we would now start the engagement process with the practitioner. The practitioner would need to supply their explanation of the allegations that have been made by the member of public or a peer practitioner. period for that practitioner to respond. All right? I'm indicating the number of days because it is often stated that our process is very long. However, the Ordi Altrum Partum rule is indeed just that. All sides must be heard, and therefore the practitioner must be given a fair opportunity to be in a position to provide their explanation. If after a 40-day period we have or have not received the explanation from the practitioner, the matter will go forward to the Committee of Preliminary Inquiry, as we feel that a 40-day period is a fair time for anybody to furnish their explanation against, to the allegations that have been made against them. What can the committee do? Once the matter is before the committee, what does the committee do with it? Number one, they could request additional information. They could consult with the practitioner or the complainant for additional information, give us an additional explanation on 1, 2, and 3, which you've indicated in your submission. They also could refer the matter directly in the cases of where there are unethical practices within a particular practitioner's premises that would need to be investigated. The HPCSA, the legal department, will send a team to go and inspect the activities within that environment if that is indeed the allegation. Or if the explanation that the practitioner has given to them is adequate, they could note the explanation, draw up the charge sheet from there, whereby the practitioner is formally charged with whatever infraction it is, whatever ethical rule that they have actually contravened. What happens from there is either the practitioner admits guilt or says that I'm not admitting guilt, I'm prepared for this matter to go forward, in which case we then will undertake a professional conduct formal inquiry, whereby a full hearing, the practitioner may be represented or may represent themselves. Once the hearing is undertaken, the committee would then have its finding and would either find the practitioner guilty or not guilty of misconduct, unethical behavior, or whatever would be the finding. A penalty would then be applied, and that would be the end of the case. After the formal hearing, remember the previous slide was matters which are finalized at prelim. These are the matters finalized after the formal hearing stage, whereby a fine or suspension or erasure or whatever the penalty would be. We are here just giving you some type of indication as to what are the penalties. In the 2007-8, 78 fines, 2009, 71, and in the 2010-64. When we look at this, we can see that certain matters, even after the formal hearing, might go back to the prelim and might just be noted at the Committee of Preliminary Inquiry as part of our process. So if we look at the formal hearing, in the 2007-8 period, there were 173 matters. 8-9 period, 190. And the 2009-10 period, 199 matters. As I alluded to earlier, we're moving on now to the next part of what we do at the HPCSA, where we indicate we protect the public and we guide the profession. How do we guide the profession? What is our role within the education framework of the South African medical practitioner's education? I thought it would be important just to give you a quick layout of how it is that we are structured, how we're accountable numbers of professionals. I'm going to run through the boards and the professions that are actually covered within our 12 professional boards. Dental therapy and oral hygiene, the profession of dietetics and nutrition, emergency care workers, this is where you have your basic ambulances, your ANAs, your environmental health practitioners, the medical and dental board, the emergency care board, and the medical and dental board were the two boards which I highlighted to you on the main number of practitioners I hosted there. Our medical technology, occupational therapy, medical orthotics and prosthetics, optometry, dispensing opticians, physiotherapy, podiatry and biokinetics, the board of psychology, radiography and clinical technology, and speech, language and the hearing profession. These all constitute our professional boards, which regulate and accredit the various programs that are run by the universities which offer the medical sciences as programs. I think it's also important to note that in terms of our systems and operations, we are governed by various committees which are accountable through to the council through our executive committee. In terms of managing our corporate governance and our finances, we have the Finance and Investment Committee, the Audit and Risk Committee, the Pension and Provident Trustee Committee, our Tender Committee, which monitors and regulates all types of work that is or procurement within the HPCSA, the Undesirable Business Practices, which seek to monitor and regulate the business activities of medical practitioners, the Health Committee. The Health Committee is a very unique committee in that it governs what we call our Section 51 practitioners. A Section 51 practitioner is a practitioner who is impaired. Impaired means that medical practitioners are just like human beings like you and I. There are mental illnesses, there are physical illnesses, there are various illnesses that they are also afflicted with. However, it is the role of the regulator to ensure, because of the cost that it costs to actually educate a medical practitioner in South Africa, it is incumbent upon us to take care of impaired practitioners and to be in a position to so-called nurse them through the period where they are indeed impaired, to bring them to being whole again and to be back in towards servicing the needs of our public. So this is what the role of the Health Committee is. Our Education and Training Assurance Committee, this is a very important committee in monitoring our accreditation of the universities and the courses which we are responsible for accrediting through the work of the professional board. We have our Professional Conduct Review Committee. I've just gone through the legal processes now, whereby we then look at the types of cases. This is where we look at the trends that have emerged. Why are practitioners always overcharging? Should we be looking at our ethical tariff? Should we be looking at the reasons why there is so much sexual misconduct within the medical fraternity? Why is this so? Why has there been an increase within this sector or within that sector? We pick up that trend analysis and we then have a committee which will review this trend and then look at ways of addressing our ethical rules. No regulation is static. We work in a moving environment, and it is important as a regulator for us to look and see how relevant we have been within that sector and how accountable are we in terms of ensuring that the ethical rules are obeyed. Our another very important committee within the healthcare environment. This is the committee that monitors contentious issues, such as, if I could give an example off the top of my head, is at the moment, the whole of the world is looking at stem cell research. Where do we stand in terms of stem cell research? We look at a very high-profile matter such as the Vison case. This is the committee which felt that we need to take a stand in terms of the human rights and ethics of our population. The human rights of our ethics of our population and the ethics of our practitioners who operate in that environment. The CPD committee. CPD means continuous professional development. Why do we have a committee that needs to regulate this? Because we are in a global environment. There are matters that are, technology is moving. There's issues such as telemedicine. There are issues that are moving within the world, and we are not, despite being at the tip of Africa, we need to keep abreast. We need to ensure that our practitioners are continuously developing themselves. Why? They need to be exercising the most modern medicine within our South African environment to ensure the standard of the healthcare that is actually delivered. We have our Human Resources and Remuneration Committee, which is there to assist the administration in matters of the remuneration of the employees and the conditions of service of the administration. All of these council committees, these are called the committees of council, that monitor the corporate governance and ensure that our operations are in line with our mandate. All of these committees report through the executive committee through to the main council. This is just a very quick indication as well of what is the council comprised. For the members who are getting very bored, I'm almost at the end. These are the boards which I've gone through in the previous slide. How is the council constituted? The council is constituted of 32 members as indicated on the previous slide. All I've done is taken the previous slide up there, and I'm unpacking how are these 32 members made up. There is one representative from each of the boards. There are 12 professional boards, but based on the numbers of practitioners that they are covering. The emergency care board has 3 persons represented on the council, and the medical and dental board has 3 persons council due to the numbers of practitioners that they represent. That brings the number to 16. We then have 9 community representatives. These 9 community representatives are nominated and appointed by the Minister of Health. We then have 1 person versed in law who is also appointed by the Minister of Health. We then have 3 persons nominated and appointed by HESA, which is the University of Deans. It's now called the Higher Education of South Africa. There are 3 persons nominated there that sit on our council. Then there is 1 person from the Department of Education, 1 person from the Department of Health, and 1 person from the Department of Correctional Services. Each of these persons are nominated by the Minister of Education, the Minister of Health, and the Minister of Defence. This total number comprises 32 members which sit on the council, and they are all under these persons will all nominate the President and the Vice President, who will then report through to the Department of Health. I've indicated that there are 12 professional boards. The professional boards control the profession within their ambit, and all of this is done under the overarching guidance and control of universities which deliver education within the medical framework, and they also accredit the programs that are administered through those universities. And in doing so, they act as a standards generating body to ensure the standards that are actually delivered in and through the institution for the development of a professional practice framework. The professional boards are also responsible for the National Strategy and Action Plan in training, supervision, and career path development within the internship area as well. It includes internships. Their role is also to evaluate registration applications. They exercise the education and training quality assurance through the ETQA committee on behalf of council. They evaluate the education and training courses of the academic facilities. They recognize the courses for registration and additional qualifications of specialists, etc., within the healthcare environment. They develop the policy documents that are required to guide the profession for the professional practice of the practitioners. They are also responsible for the conducting of the preliminary and professional conduct inquiry. They are the persons who sit on those committees, because we would be looking in some cases at the qualifications and the competencies of practitioners. They formulate the regulations and the rules of conduct and the professional practice of practitioners. They assess non-compliant applications for registration, which includes the foreign applications. In terms of issues of our service delivery, we service the public and the healthcare practitioners. Before we moved to a new platform, we conducted an intensive high-level investigation to ensure that we undertake our mandate within the public and within the practitioner base that we have to serve. And by having done that, we implemented a number of methods to improve our service delivery. I want to just indicate that service delivery also needs people and processes to deliver service to our stakeholders. We have three contact points within the HPCSA. You can contact us through the email, through our walk-in call center, and on telephonically through our call center. I indicated earlier that we service approximately 180,000 practitioners through a rigorous registration and accreditation and legal process. At the moment, we look in our registration section as one agent, one person, would need to service about 11,250 practitioners. One call center agent would need to service 11,250 practitioners. At our walk-in center in Pretoria, we have one agent within the finance department would be needing to service 22,500 practitioners. The registration official, one agent in the walk-in environment, would need to service 5,000 practitioners. Clearly, when one looks at this, one can see that the need for us to have moved to a more electronic methodology of servicing our population, it was almost a no-brainer, because physically it is impossible to actually service adequately the type of environment with this number of bodies to service that number of practitioners. However, as I indicated earlier, we do not receive any funding from government or treasury, and as an autonomous organization, we need to work within our budget framework, and we need to be accountable to the practitioners who actually pay their fees through to the HPCSA. have undertaken some proactive initiatives to ensure a better service through within the parameters that we are working with. We've got a customer services officer for critical complaints that are then escalated. There's a defined escalation process of a 24-hour turnaround time. We have an intensive complaints procedure for service delivery. Subscription, we have recently subscribed to a complaints bureau called Hello Peter, where we note what the public is saying about our service delivery and we're acting upon it. Initiatives to encourage electronic communication with practitioners. We feel that if we could really change the mindset of practitioners in dealing with us, our service delivery can improve within our restricted financial resources framework by practitioners, number one, ensuring that they keep their contact details and their address details updated by giving us an electronic methodology of communicating with them. Our website is continuously updated, our emails, through our newsletter and special information campaigns. For example, the way in which we communicate our annual fee reminders. Our processes have been streamlined to make the experience simpler and more efficient. Having covered most of the areas, if I could just take a moment just to catch my breath, and then I'll be in a position to address any questions through the chair.
Thank you very much. Are you catching your breath now? Thank you very much. Mama Rilla Orilla. Members, I think we're all aware that health is health because there are professionals there. And I think this is a very important information that you are getting because that's where these health professionals are. Not controlled, but they're looked at whether they are practicing ethically. And that's why we wanted to see HPCSA talking to us so that we can know. Because if we say there are challenges in health, both private and public, we mean the professionals that are there are not doing well. And what is Health Professions Council of South Africa doing about that? So that's why we've got you here. We've noticed that there's a lot of litigation in institutions, specifically in the public sector, even in the private sector. We wonder whether those are related to the unethical behavior of the professionals, but it's something that maybe you can tell us what's going on. There's something they call remunerative work outside public service, which they call AROS. Maybe if you could touch on that, what is it and how do you regulate that? Because it's happening in certain areas and there seems to be challenges. And the other thing, do you have field workers besides where you get your information? Like the example that I made, that in Northwest there's a doctor who's still doing racial discrimination where Africans are seen in a particular way. And in fact, I heard him saying on the radio that nobody's going to tell him, neither ANC nor HPSA. He actually said it on the radio himself. So maybe now the members are going to be asking you a few questions. But before we do that, maybe let's tell you who is here. Because we didn't tell you the people that are, but we told them who you are. Next to you, you've got a lady there called Honorable Michelle. Behind her, we've got Honorable Dr. Luthuli. She has a beret, but I don't know what happened to her beret now. It's quite hot. Then we need the air conditioner. The red lady, Sue Grace, Mamu Grace Dube. Behind the Grace, Mamu Dube, we've got Mamu Mafolo, Honorable Mafolo, with long hair. a map to her. We go to Mamu Kenya with a beautiful hairstyle. I don't know, maybe you can see whether is it ethical to have beautiful hairstyles here or not.
I don't see why not.
Oh, why not? Oh, okay. On the other side, you have got on. We've got Undate Khanare, Honorable Khanare, sitting there. Next to Undate Khanare, we've got Uma Emma. She's got another hairstyle too. Then we've got Honorable Mike Waters. The big man that is sitting next to me is the whip of the committee. We chose him because he's bigger than everybody. We chose him to be the whip. Myself, I'm Vivian Kotwana. We've got people who are assisting us, a researcher and the secretary next to me. We always invite Nehao to be here. I'm not sure whether they're not doing, but she's here. I think Nehao is not an auditor today. They will be tomorrow, not today. And also, okay. So those are the people that are going to be asking you questions. Members, that you've got what's happening in the Health Professions Council of South Africa. Maltule, before you ask Maltule, you mentioned something about water person. I think we would need to get more detail as to what is going on. We're just interested in the cardiologist report as to why is he practicing with all these other things on us. Just for information.
Maltule.
Mike.
CEO, can you switch off your...
doesn't even know that the interpreter is going in another direction.
thanks, Malcolm. What will suggest you do? Switch off Malcolm. What will suggest is that you jot down some of this. They will ask and then you can answer and then we'll come back again. Will that be okay with you?
Yeah, would it be possible if I could just address these three now and the next person asks, or do you want 10 questions, 20 or whatever, because there's already about 5 questions there. Yeah? I'm comfortable to do it anyway if you guide.
Let me make two suggestions. Can I suggest to members if we could ask fewer questions and then we'll have another round and then we'll give over the first round for everybody, you jot them down, but we'll try and make them short and not many, and then we're still going to have another round. So, Makenya, if you could help us with that, just few questions and then we'll just jot them down and then when we finish, you'll answer them.
Okay.
I always have a few questions. My question is on what is your relationship with South African Nursing Council? They say that HPC is a regulated health professional. Because to my understanding, the Nursing Council has got its own subscription. Two, you said that social responsibility, you are on social responsibility, you are actively involved in local communities. In what way are you involved in local communities? Thirdly, you said social board develop social practice framework and controls the profession. Also, it is a great area to me. Maybe are you working together with the Nursing Council? That's why I'm confused, because I think there's a lot which is a great area because of this annual subscription in the HPCSC. Thank you.
Second, Nema Fola, Venetian Bureau. Oh, I've been looking on one side. Sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. Mine is only one question. I just want to know that because you are registering health professionals, I want to know about the agreement. I once asked why we are lacking some of the professions in our country, and I don't know, the district manager said there's an agreement between countries that if there is a skill that is cast aside, you can't take that person from another country and bring him to your country. I just want to understand about that. How do you register the cast youth? Thanks.
I think so. Maybe we should have called you with one or two people from the Department of Health. But I think it was something that we didn't pick up. Okay, Mema Shell, and then we're coming with that.
Mine is just one question in addition to what Honorable Kenya has asked about your social responsibility. To say in what way are you involved and where about the country are you involved with nine provinces, and what type of activities do you give to our local community?
Yes, Emma. Honorable Emma.
Okay, thank you very much. My first question pertains to the registration. I'm not sure whether partially, I think I've been answered in terms of you speaking about Oracle, but that was last year November when you sort of piloted it or something. I just wanted to know the time it takes for one to get a card after the process of registration is taken. A lot of professionals are complaining. And remember, according to the law, you must have your card on you all the time. Should the patient ask you for instance, in a hospital that are you registered, you know, for whatever reason, you must be able to show them the card. The law requires that. But the time it takes after the processing of the registration itself to get a card is a challenge. I'm not sure whether Oracle is going to address this, but can you give us a scenario or Yeah, give us a scenario to say what is happening now that you've got hold of in terms of the delay. And then the other mandate is speaking about the CPD, ensuring that it happens and fostering compliance. I'm not sure, we've got staff shortage in South Africa, medical staff shortage, be it allied, nurse, doctor. How does this shortage impact on you as HPCSA, especially the professional bodies, fostering compliance? Because in my experience, you are unable, if you are short staff, you are unable to attend CPD activities or CEU's activities at all. Because somebody has to be on duty all the time. You cannot prioritize attending a CPD activity or session and leave the patients alone. We've got that problem in most hospital institutions. So I want to know if HPCSA has sat down with the Department of Health and talk about this issue, because probably when you find that a lot of members did not comply, that would be, to some extent, one of the reasons why people don't attend the CPD or comply with the unit per annum. And then the annual fee, my question was, yeah, most people ask, why should I pay? You know, what does the HPCSA do for me? And, yeah, you answered that during your presentation. And then with the electronic system that you had, I wanted to know about the efficiency because of this problem of taking too long for people to receive their cards after registration. But now maybe Oracle will, I don't know, address all the issues. And currently, or on the internet, we cannot access the register. It's not accessible. Can you explain that? Because now you've got Oracle. And then, yeah, social responsibility, some of the members of Oracle. On that, and then my second last question. On practicing without current registration constitutes a criminal offense. I'm not sure, do you have any measures that you put in place to fast track the delivery of the card? Because like you said, if you don't have the card, you can't practice. But I said it's not because you don't want to have the card. You register, there's one a scenario where a doctor would register 3 months before, but they will stay the whole year without a card. And I mean, the implication of that is that they shouldn't be working, and that impact on service delivery. And then, yeah, you spoke about countries that you cannot recruit from, and blah, 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 if you can know those countries and the reason. The last one, the issue of training, better supervision. Yeah, on the professional board, there's this clause or code or whatever in one of their policy frameworks that you cannot train an X number of, let's say, doctors. Because in your hospital currently you don't have supervisors, because when they come back they must work under supervision. I'm not sure with this, because for me it's like a vicious cycle. We've got staff shortage, we cannot train more, you know. So have you sat down and come up with maybe a law that will breach, you know, this clause that says you cannot train, increase your training numbers because we've got less supervisors, because there'll always be less people are leaving anyway. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Mike, yeah, he's going to be the last one and then your answer. But I must say, I registered within 3 days. I had a card. I don't know whether that was a mistake, but that was the experience that I had. Okay, Mike.
Thank you, Chair. The probably still is your name, so Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee.
No, it's not now. It was long ago, Mike. Not now.
Thank you for the presentation. I just want to ask with regards to foreign doctors working here. When there's an agreement between our country and foreign countries like Cuba or Tunisia, do you still get involved to ascertain whether the foreign doctors coming over actually meet minimum requirements, or are they exempt? And can you unpack that? Because I take it they still require a letter of endorsement from the department, and do they get their 6 monthly reports as well? And I mean, I've heard of foreign doctors, like the Cubans in particular, working in hospitals alone. So which medical office actually provides those reports? Then as far as the number of professionals on that page, I mean, I've taken this as the current number of professionals. Everyone, this one, we're all paid. Okay, so this is the actual current. How many applications do you receive a year for people wanting to work overseas? I think they could have a letter of good standing, or I don't know if that's the right terminology. But
And then as far as what Honourable Moray raised about the lack of doctors and the fact that we have a chronic shortage in this country, as far as increasing the number of doctors being trained at universities, are you engaging the private sector in any way at all? I'm actually repeating the question, but how do you intend increasing the number of doctors being trained in this country? And when will we see an improvement on that? And then the last aspect I want to raise, Chair, is the amount of legal or complaints against doctors. I mean, if you look at this page, it's unnumbered, so I can't refer you to the page, but you said you received 2,310 complaints in the last financial year, and 2008-09 financial year, and 2,703 in the 2009-10 financial year. That gives you just over 5,000 complaints in those 2 years. Of that, 491 were referred to the Ombudsman, and you dealt with 719 and 651, which gives you about 1,850. And that means there's a deficit of close to 3,100 cases for those 2 years alone, which must mean there's a huge backlog. And you haven't given any indication of the backlog and how far back some of these cases are going. So could you just unpack that for us? And then my last question, Chair, refers to the EMS short courses. There's been a lot of talk in the paper that you wanted to stop the short courses, and I think the first two, if I remember correctly, the first two courses at the end of this year. What is happening with that? I know the minister has to agree with it. I don't think the council has the authority to stop those courses. But what is happening? Because there seems to be a lot of confusion out there as to what the intentions of the council are. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks. And Dr. Khanna? Yeah, the last one.
Yeah, Chair, I apologize because I thought the members would ask the question, so I don't usually have to repeat the question.
They are forgiven.
What I want to know, I mean, following what Dr. Lee said, if doctors don't know the role of HPCSA, and they don't know how to access it, what steps are they taking to make sure that the members of the public, particularly the poor, who don't know how to complain, because mostly the poor women can be treated badly and they just accept it, if the doctor is a nurse, it's not like that. What steps have they taken to make sure that ordinary people know what their role is and how to access them, for in case they've got complaints? The other one is only two questions. The other one is the making sure that community services, particularly doctors, work under conducive conditions, that they are able to achieve what they are supposed to do. I mean, our example is we went to Belcom Hospital, where the doctors were complaining about the conditions under which they were working, and the hospital's understanding of the community training doctors was completely different from our own understanding. And basically, we say that it might be something common in all hospitals. Why do we do to ensure that these people are working under conditions?
Thanks,
Dr.
Khanna. Members, there is a concern that I'm not giving you a fair share of answering. There's nobody that has stopped asking. All I said, I'm requesting, because we are all adults, I'm requesting that we be short so that we can give a time to respond to them. I still say that if we could be short, but I'm not going to stop anybody if they want to continue asking questions. But this was the first round. Maybe we'll give over to you. But the important thing, all the questions that you've been given, if you could just cluster them and then answer them in those clusters. But what you'll understand is that we think the HPCSA is one of the important things as far as health in South Africa. That's why you're going to be getting a lot of questions coming from us. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, members. There's some excellent questions
here that are not covered on the presentation, which I think will be helpful for all those other issues and our solutions to cover them. I'm going to start and address it in no particular order, but as the chairperson has indicated, there's a couple of overlaps, and I'll address them accordingly. If I could perhaps start with my role and the question raised by Dr. Matuzi. I am the Chief Operations Officer of the HPCSA and the so-called number 2IC. After the resignation of the then registrar, it then became incumbent upon me to take over the reins in the position of acting. I have been in that position of the acting registrar and CEO from the 1st of February. I would like to indicate to the members that as the Chief Operations Officer, you, the de facto person who actually gets on and does most of everything, you're just not the person in the face of the public eye in terms of what needs to be done operationally at the HPCSA. The regulations clearly indicate that the registrar and CEO of the HPCSA is appointed by the minister. So that process will be undertaken by the Department of Health, and it is not a matter which the council deals with. It is dealt with through the minister's office at the Department of Health. So in terms of the so-called role of acting, once the position is advertised, etc., the minister takes charge and the Department of Health takes charge. Until then, accountability does not change. I am indeed the accountable person and the accounting officer in the position of acting. I think the issue of foreign qualified doctors is an issue that is at the heart of the way in which the Department of Health has to try and address the issues of our extreme shortages. One of the questions that Mr. Waters asked is, how does one go about monitoring and what is the letter of good standing? A question that was raised by Parliament about 2 months ago was, are we able to track and monitor the so-called outflow of medical practitioners? I'm addressing the issues that were asked about the foreign qualifiers, but I'm coming from the other end now, is that how do we know the number of practitioners that are or not in our country? A letter of good standing is required by many institutions within South Africa as an indication of the competencies that a doctor actually has. So there is no way of us establishing that if a person wants a letter of good standing, which is what we call a CLS, then that is the number of people that are leaving the country. Because if you would like to be employed by a Medicross or a life care clinic, as part of your employment, they request a letter of good standing. So by taking the number of CLSs that we have actually issued as an indication of the outflow of practitioners is not a correct way of doing it. So I want to caution members clearly by getting that bit of information and then saying practitioners are leaving the country in droves is an incorrect way of actually doing that. The way in which foreign qualified practitioners come into our country and are managed. Firstly, this is, to start off with, an immigration aspect which is out of the hands of the HPCSA. The Department of Health manages the whole process. They have a department called the Foreign Workforce Management Group. Their role and responsibility is firstly to check the competencies of these practitioners. And that is why we clearly indicate on the presentation that the letter of endorsement is the first step that we start with practitioners. That is that
has come through a screening process by the Foreign Workforce Management Group. That is the one way. We then touched on issues of government-to-government agreements. All right? That government-to-government agreement that Mr. Waters alluded to was the agreement whereby the government enters one government to another. For example, we have doctors from Russia, doctors from various areas within Europe and in Cuba. The qualifications, etc., and the screening that is done by the Department of Health, we still have to register those practitioners. And when the regulation changed, that is when the 1 year in public service came into being. Then we look at the issues of how do we register. They all will come in as a medical practitioner, but the 12-month probationary period is where the person's competencies are then established. And we see, is this person competent within a 6-month period and then another 12-month period? And if you look at the exam track and the non-exam track, it's clearly evident that before they can move on from there, they would need to undertake an accreditation of our standard of education. So the exam track and the non-exam track is for two different things, and the outcomes would be, are these so-called foreign qualified then further competent to go into independent practice? So I think in terms of the government-to-government agreement, the pre-screening is done by the Department of Health. In terms of the language issues and the issues of the way in which these professionals engage with our public, that is why that 1 year period has been put in place by the government. Those are regulations which are clear, which we have to follow in terms of the registration of these practitioners. I then want to move on in terms of what do we do? What is our role within the protection of the public? What do we do to have an awareness of the ordinary person who talks to the mama out in the real rural area of the city or Flagstaff to say that a doctor cannot treat you poorly? What is it that we are doing from our perspective in terms of ensuring that what we do gets rolled out into the rural communities? Number one, whilst we have all the normal ways of addressing people electronically, having posters put up in various hospitals, people are in some cases illiterate. They cannot read those rules and the complaint procedure that is outlined on these posters. Therefore, we've embarked in an intensive radio campaign whereby we have almost on a monthly basis, we have the head of our legal services, Advocate Boikanyo, speaking on the radio such as Motswedi. I don't know the names of all of those radio stations on my fingertips, but those, what do they call them, the regional radio stations, because we believe that if we target the audio media, a person does not need to be literate to listen, and they can still become aware of what the role is and what their rights are as patients. So we feel that we've had a very good, and we've put out a very good imprint over the last 2 years, and if needed be, we can supply you with the PR, the media monitoring report on the response that we've had in terms of addressing those rural environments through the radio as an auditory media for spreading what we actually do. In terms of an overlapping question which came from a couple of the members was the increase in the legal complaints. This, when the Professional Conduct Review Committee, as I indicated, they are the committee that actually look at the trends and look to see why has there been an increase, but not necessarily
we drill down further to see what were the areas of non-compliance leading to an increase in the number of cases. When we looked at that, we could clearly see, and this was an intensive study that was conducted from 2008, because we had already seen, whilst it's not indicated there, we looked at from 2000 to, I've only given you the statistics from 2005. We looked at from beforehand, from almost 2000, in fact 1998, and we tried to see that there's been a steady incline in the number of cases. Now, it could be a number of reasons why. Number one, our outreach in terms of making the population aware of their rights could be working, in that the activities we've undertaken to tell the population, you have rights, you can complain, this is what you would need to do, has been successful. Therefore, we see an increase in the number of complaints. Alternatively, it could be that the actual conduct of medical practitioners is actually on the decline. And in terms of that, what did we do about it? We then went back to the universities. And we said to the universities, what we've noted is a lack of moral conduct, a lack of compliance with the ethical rules. Therefore, what we need to do is we need to ingrain ethical behavior within the courses that are given. And over the last 3 years, a regulation went through council whereby we actually put in a percentage of the way in which ethics must be constituted and instituted within the curricula of the various medical courses. And the way in which we police and monitor that is through our accreditation process, whereby when the teams of medical practitioners go out to accredit the faculties and indeed the courses, they need to prove that one of the criteria in the accreditation process is indeed ethics are ingrained right from first year level in through to the exit level. So in that way, it is a long-term process of improving the ethical behavior and conduct of a medical practitioner, but it is something we have seen over the years that ethics can be taught. It is not just a natural thing that is inherent within people, and it is part of professional conduct to ensure that ethics is ingrained within the various courses that are actually being undertaken. So, in terms of the legal cases, it would be a long-term process for us to see the fruits of that, but I think it's important for us to note that there are various contributing factors as to why the professional conduct cases would increase. And clearly, that is indeed our role, and it is not alarming that the cases have increased. It means that the outreach that we've undertaken to make the awareness out to the public to say you can't complain, we've looked at it and said that whatever we're doing must be correct in that complaints are increasing, because there are activities out there that are still not being reported. So in that way, I think a lot more can be done by us in terms of our outreach. And as the Honourable Member indicated, constantly moving out there into the under-resourced areas, the underprivileged areas, where doctors still have the prestige that's being awarded to them, and yet the delivery does not always meet that need in terms of our protection of the public in that regard. I think I need to address that the HPCSA does not operate in a vacuum within the healthcare environmental sector. There are other statutory bodies, the National Health Council, the Pharmacy Council, the Social Services Council, all of us operate environment. And from time to time, the HPCSA, we engage with these various statutory bodies, because at the end of the day, we need to meet our mandate of protection of the public. And as one would be well aware, within a hospital, doctors do not work without the nurses, as one of the members indicated. What is our role with the nursing council? At the moment, there is a body within the Department of Health called the Forum for Statutory Councils, whereby all of us councils sit around the table and we discuss issues of overlap. When I say issues of overlap, there's issues such as the scope of practice of a medical practitioner. For example, you will get areas where certain practitioners feel that they would need to prescribe. Or a physiotherapist feels that they need to prescribe. This is an encroachment on one of the other areas within our framework. Therefore, the pharmacy council, the nursing council, we all sit together and say, look, these are areas, the outcome is the same. We all have the same mandate in terms of servicing the population within the regulatory framework, each with various specific mandates. So the nursing council regulates the nurses. We regulate all the other medical practitioners. I want to perhaps now move on to the areas that were raised by Councillor Emma in terms of our operations and issues in terms of the registration. I thought it was important for the members here to note the reasons why we needed to move to Article 4 were exactly those enumerated by the honourable member. Issues such as not being able to issue the practicing card or the system falling down. We have long queues. When it comes to what we call our peak period, we have in excess of thousands in a day, maybe up to about 5,000 in one day of queues. On the 30th and the 31st of March, the HPCSA is a very unpleasant place, because we have queues that are going round the corners, you know, on both sides. I want to very clearly indicate that it is incumbent upon the practitioners to know that they need to be registered. It is a requirement of the Act, which has been endorsed by you sitting here, that practitioners need to be registered. They will pay an annual fee to the HP to be registered. However, like human nature is, they leave it to the last minute and have an expectation that, you know, they can get there on that date. And we do aim to actually service practitioners on those days. And for that need, we hire teams. We do what is necessary to be of service to the practitioners at the end of the day. However, as the Honourable Chairperson said, you can walk into the HPC and get your practicing card over the counter, but many practitioners do not have that luxury if they are residing in the far ends of Limpopo or the Eastern Cape, whatever. Therefore, they have to utilise the mail service and communication with the mail service. But as I also showed you, 38% of the applications we receive are non-compliant. So the frustrations that we sit with are non-compliant applications, trying to then communicate with the practitioner who's not updated their address. And therefore, they would say, but I applied 4 months ago and I've not received anything as yet. Then we sit with a ratio of one call centre agent to 11,000 practitioners on the call centre, where they'll say, I've tried to call and I've tried to call numerous times. You will wait in the queue because of just the nature of the way in which it's done. However, we do have a turnaround time of between 21 to 28 days, in which if you use even the snail mail, that is the turnaround time. for you to actually get your practicing card. So in terms of our operations, I do believe that we are getting smarter and better at doing it, purely because we are moving on to a more electronic base to service our clients. Continuous professional development. I think we need to look at the reasons why continuous professional development has been instituted as a prerequisite for professional service. Any of the professions that we look at, if you look at an accountant, if you look at an attorney, there is indeed a need for those professionals to be updated and to ensure that they know the latest methodology. If you hire an attorney, there's no way that you would hire one who has not updated and familiarized himself with the most current legislation to be in a position to fight their case and for you to win. Likewise, as a regulator, we need to ensure that our population is getting the best updated treatment that would be available. And as the professional, it would be incumbent upon them to ensure that they keep their knowledge base and the way in which we're delivering healthcare services to the population in the most updated way. In terms of the way in which CEUs are actually attained, they are dependent on the profession. The requirement is 60 CEUs over a 2-year period. Compliancy with respect to that, I want to indicate to the members that we've done random audits. We're on the second round of undertaking a random audit. And I want to confidently state that we do not find many persons not compliant over the 2-year period. So the issues that have been raised as to how do practitioners ensure that they remain compliant in terms of their CPD units? I think that it would be engagement, and also the practitioner themselves would need to say, am I really delivering the most updated service that I could render as a professional? And I think if they honestly looked at that question, which would be an ethical dilemma for them, they would be in a position to say, we need to be in a position and to engage our employers to state that, what are you doing to make us be better professionals at delivering a professional service out to the community? So the way in, and based on the compliancy, the 60 CEUs that are actually the required number for the various professions, I'm just giving the most number that would need to be acquired over the 2-year period. Compliance has not been an issue, and where there has been non-compliant behavior, an explanation and a recommendation from that individual to say, this is what I intend to do, is always looked at within that profession and by that professional board. So I think we need to look at what is the role of the regulator. We need to protect the public. How do we protect the public? By ensuring we have competent practitioners out there and continuously improving the qualifications is how competency within the work environment will be maintained. An aspect that was raised is, and also one of the first questions that was raised by, the first comments that was actually raised by the Honourable Chairperson, was how do we increase the number of doctors? Because we have foreign qualified because we have a shortage. So what is it that we're doing within our country to increase the number? At the moment we have the 7 institutions that actually churn out or produce medical practitioners. We have a statistic of, it varies, but I'm going to stand under correction. We should be churning out 1,200 practitioners, medical doctors. I'd like to specify and say 1,200 doctors is what our medical school can produce. However, we need to look at a number of contributing factors as to why we are not producing that number. There's many contributing factors which are out of the scope and the domain of the HPCSA. For example, university entry requirements. For example, the lack of adequate math and science graduates that would enter into the medical field. Those types of issues are squarely on the shoulders of the Department of Education, and they need to be looked at in that section and in that area. Our role is to accredit the actual courses that are undertaken. We need to look at the courses. We need to look at how these courses are going to address the medical needs of the South African population. We need to see and look at international best practice in terms of how are our practitioners going to be accredited and trained for the outcomes and the needs of our rural environments, etc. So in terms of looking at that, while we do not have any control, and as Dr. Latuli said, your powers are limited in terms of the outcomes and what you are here to answer up, and the Department of Health would need to be addressing a number of those issues. I'd like to just backtrack a little and perhaps speak about the training platform, which one of the members also alluded to in terms of what is the conditions of service of community service doctors. I'll tie that up together with what we call the training platform. For example, the University of Cape Town has to have training platforms for the fifth year interns and your various years. The reasons why students need to be registered is before any student can even go to those learning platforms or touch a member of our population, they need to be registered. So that is why we have student registration, to ensure that if a student, together with their so-called supervisor, medical officer, or supervisor within that registrar framework of a hospital. Remember, an intern cannot learn if they do not have a learned person guiding them through the learning process. So, we have what we call our learning platforms, which the agency's responsibility is to go and accredit that. Remember, we are accrediting the professional which comes out through multiple processes of learning. It is the university, it is the training platform, which could be a community hospital, it could be a clinic, it could be a training hospital, it could be various types of hospitals. Mr. Waters asked, are we engaging the private sector in this? There are various universities who are directly engaging with the private sector for a means of providing an adequate learning platform for the learning to take place in the full 360-degree methodology. So, if I get back to the issue of the learning platform, we go to these learning platforms and we go and accredit them. We need to see, is the situation conducive for learning to take place in that environment? When we get there, often we see inadequate environments. Our responsibility is to report that environment to the Department of Health, stating that we have an intern who has to go out to a community clinic as a learning platform and a learning environment. When they get there, there are only nursing staff available. So we have a learner and an inadequate supervisor of that learning to take place. However, the HPCSA's role cannot change the situation at that particular clinic, because it's the Department of Health's responsibility to ensure that there is a medical officer or a registrar present when this first-year student comes to that environment to get the adequate training. So I think, as Dr. Lutuli indicated, our powers are indeed limited. What is it that we do? We are constantly engaging with the Department of Health, stating that if we are to accredit medical practitioners when they go out there, you need to meet the needs of the population and ensure that there is adequate supervision for these professionals. And that then directly impacts the output at the end of the day of how many practitioners are being churned out for the population. So whilst we are accrediting, and our role is to accredit the learning framework, which would include those inadequate learning platforms, constant engagement by us with the Department of Health is necessary for us to ensure that that learning takes place full circle. In terms of remuneration outside of the public sector, this is still allowed. Whilst it is not a practice that we condone and engage, clearly it's a Department of Health initiative, and it is not something that is within our control. So all work is undertaken, and there seems to be a move afoot from the department to reduce this. However, I think that the Department of Health would be in a position to address that question more adequately. In terms of, I want to move now on to the last section, which I think would be our professional conduct. Unfortunately, firstly, I want to say up front that I'm not familiar with the case in the Northwest right now. However, I will be in a position to request a bit of research done, and perhaps we could give a formal answer back through to the committee in writing that we could submit in terms of that particular case. You would understand that there are a number of cases. It's difficult for me to, you know, as this movement and what is considered as high profile, that would be brought to my attention. In terms of the Basson matter, I fleetingly mentioned that when I spoke about the Human Rights and Ethics Committee. The role of a regulator is indeed to protect the human rights within the healthcare sector. The Basson matter received lots and lots of media attention, and we are at the stage where, for persons, if I could just put it in a nutshell quickly, Dr. Basson undertook a number of activities under the guise of being medical research, etc. I'm not going to go through the whole case because the chairperson asked where is the matter now. We received a positive turn from the High Court in that we won the last litigation round, which was where he went through to court and he indicated that he did not want to come and be prosecuted through our professional conduct of inquiry. He went to the High Court indicating that he deserved, he'd been through a civil procedure and therefore he does not feel that he needs to go through our professional conduct. We contested the matter and we won that round, and he will present himself before our process of professional conduct. However, he He's now gone on appeal on the matter, and therefore the matter is still with the High Court, and he has the right to appeal in terms of our judicial system. So we are still at the High Court with him, whereby that process will be appealed. But I think the importance of that is the role that we play as a regulator. The difficulty is that I indicated earlier that the practitioners are the persons who actually are putting the bill for the ethical rights to be protected. And a matter such as a high profile matter like that indeed deep into our coffers in terms of us employing professional senior legal counsel in terms of defending such a matter. But I think in what the population should look at us as a regulator and see that irrespective of the extent of a matter like that, as a regulator, it is incumbent upon us to take a stand. And I think the whole world is looking at us in terms of the outcome of that matter. We have a lot of international press who participate in those hearings because of the ethical nature that is going to be covered and a precedent is going to be set in terms of chemical warfare. Can a practitioner hide behind issues of war and state that they can undertake atrocities or under the guise of it was warfare, it was war? And I think that as South Africa, we are indeed proud to state that we will set a precedent, however long it's been taking to undertake this. But I think as a regulator, we will be doing something about it.
Thank you. Thank you, Governor. Well, you know, we don't have a problem of time. What we have a problem is that I don't want us to bombard her with so many questions that she can't answer, but we're going to have enough time because the other group that was supposed to come has not come. So we'll give over to the next round of questions.
Chairperson, may I please beg the committee's indulgence and request a body break for 2 minutes.
Okay. We can have a 5 minute break. Okay, for all of us. It's a smoke break, whatever you call it. But I see the way you're sitting here is not going on.
I think I'm not a parliamentary, but it's that committee, the NPOP, if not the net joint, or smaller colleagues.
Massacre.
The net joint. Now, Bogland is thinking, probably, and now they're thinking of Babi. Select committee on women, children, and people with disabilities.
On women,
children, No, we're supposed to finish it. Yeah. You want me to lose my job? Hey, chat and couple, my loan to you, the leak. You tell me, give me some.
Hey,
mumble,
you're so good
at the leak,
But you know what I wanted to say for the fact that
tried getting married. So,
what? Cape Town was the
same. No, I'm just thinking about the one. Which what was happening in the house here over the weekend?
Where? When? Oh.
You know what? The interesting thing that I kind of,
yeah.
You remember the young doctor, right?
Yeah.
She keep on whispering to me that about the young doctor.
Oh, expect
your 20% is going to be coming. Yeah, because she keeps on.
Uncles will see me arriving. So I'm coming to connect. Somebody who's only been so mild, anyway, it's not my problem. I never said he was going to do that. I told you that I'm old.
We must finish then before half past.
No, how I wish I could go and see him being fun.
No,
it's at 2 o'clock in the parliament.
I know it's
because of the media. I think it would have been nice to do it in parliament, but I think they want to do it there because of us.
Okay, so
you're leaving now, or you live towards half past? It's still 12 now.
I'll wait for.
Okay. Why don't we call her now?
By this lady, it's more
I usually pay for a specialist rate. I can't remember how much it is. I think it's about 500 for specialist. I don't think it's more than
500.
Yeah. You're saying that she was in
the same place. It's too little, Chef.
But what are they doing for them? The question that has been coming from doctors, what are they doing for the doctors? There's very little that. The only thing is that they are more for the community than the doctors themselves. So that's why the doctors are asking. So, can you call them?
Yeah.
Okay. But the nurses are paying quite a substantial amount, but it's not like the doctors. It's like, I don't know how much they are paying.
Okay.
No, she was not there. But she came back. Are we going to be seeing two cops now in parliament? The only one couple. Let's restart again. There are people who want to leave early by half past. They want to be. They have gone. We're supposed to finish at 1 o'clock. So, members, if you've got any further questions that you want to ask, this is your time once again. But I want to say part of marketing, and I'm not sure whether I should say marketing of the Health Professions Council of South Africa. That's part of the reason why we called you to come and tell us what's happening, so that as members of Parliament, we can be on the lookout as whether the irregularities that are done by the professionals, so that we can report to you, So part of your work members is to go out and make sure that you look at things that are done, that are unethical, done by people. You know, the act that makes you to be a body was in 1974. Now, one wonders, because the situation at that time was totally different from the situation now. In fact, it impinges on that language problem, because then it didn't matter whether you do your medical school in Afrikaans, but you're still allowed to go and work in Transkei with the patients that are speaking Xhosa, not knowing Afrikaans. That was not a problem then. But not only that, I'm not sure whether the Act of 1974 has managed to transform your institution to be a South African institution that responds to South African problems. You still find that there's a lot of disparities between what's happening in the rural areas and in the urban areas as far as unethical behavior from some of the professionals. We know in some areas there are some people who at some stage were using one needle to give injections. Probably it's no more like that, but it used to happen quite often. And you won't get what it when you talk about HIV and AIDS. But maybe that act needs to be looked into, and that is not your job probably, it's our job to relook at it. When we are talking about the shortage of professionals and all these other things that were mentioned, the litigation, we have got, as South Africa, we are a member state on those MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. It would be interesting just to hear from the Health Professions Council of South Africa. Do you think, are we going to be achieve the Millennium Development Goals? And that goes to the question that we are having a lot of baby deaths recently. Is it because of the doctors are doing unethical things, or is there something else, or it's a complicated situation that you cannot base on any particular person? Or is it the government does not level the ground for them to work? Your CPDs, what about the specialists? Are you having CPDs for specialists? Sometimes you ask yourself, your professional, like a professional doctor who's driving on N1 going to Joburg, he meets with an accident. And people don't know that this person, the doctor, is coming to help. And they start pushing him around, and what are the things that we are doing as the health professor to protect them or make them out, be known that when a doctor gets there, people should give him space so that he could do the work in an ethical... I'm not sure that you understand the question. One time people were saying that doctors should have red lights so that even if you are not in a place where you are practicing, if there happens to be a problem, if somebody collapses here, a doctor needs to stand up and do something. But how protected am I in doing that particular job? These are some of the things. Accrediting your institutions. We met up with an interesting situation in Bongani Hospital in Free State, where there are community service doctors. But what we learned there, those community service doctors are actually being used for service more than being trained. In fact, they complain that they are working alone, without any particular doctor. And that institution, we take it that is accredited by you to have community service doctors. But as we are talking to you, we thought we were going to bring them here, but the thing is still being handled by the department in Free State. We thought we were going to bring them here so that they could talk to you. They don't have any supervision. They gave us all the things that were happening. So members, this is the time for you to ask questions. But as I said, the problem is not the time. The problem, we don't want to bombard her with a lot of questions so that she forgets. I'm not trying to protect her. The last time I looked this side, now I better look this side first and then come that side.
Before the honorable chair takes the question, I noted that there were two or three questions that I didn't cover. So I'd like to just be given the opportunity just to cover them before I take the next round or with the next round.
I would suggest that you take them with the next round.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know if Mr. O'Reilly's going to address my questions, but some of them weren't answered. The one about the letters of good standing, I hear what you said, that there's no distinction between someone going overseas or working in the private sector, but how many letters of good standing have you been asked to give? And maybe it's something we should look into, that there should be a differentiation between someone who wants a letter of good standing to work in South Africa as opposed to working overseas, because it will give us a good indication of how many people are actually leaving. But anyway, just a thought.
Maybe, Mark, why don't we ask you? Because even for myself, I don't think it's that specific. What is the purpose of the question? Is the question trying to find out how many people leave the country? Or is the purpose of the question to say how many good doctors do we have that can go to another place in South Africa or outside South Africa? That's what I want to understand.
Both.
It's
both.
Actually both.
Both.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Then as far as the litigation issues, I mean, you didn't touch on how many cases in the backlog and how many years back it goes as well, because that was the one issue. And then the other issue on the EMS about phasing out the first and second tier, which you haven't mentioned that. And also, if you've in your reply, if you can talk about the litigation costs around that issue, whether there are any for the council or not, and if so, how much has it cost the council to date on those court cases? And then just one new question, Chair, because they all were previous questions. On the accreditation of learning platforms, you mentioned that there has been some communication with the private sector. How many private sector institutions have been accredited as a learning platform for doctors? Thank you, Chair.
As I said, probably we needed to have the Department of Health here. And maybe what you can help us is to tell us who do you work with, which directorate are you really, because now some of the questions are pertaining to the departments specifically. Malto, you remember I said I won't stop anybody, but as long as we try and control our questions. Okay, it's going Malto, the whip, and okay.
Yeah. I think, Chair, you touched on the question that I have to also bring out because it's been in my mind. Now, I think it shows the concern and the gravity of it acting register. It's this thing of accreditation of what you call it now, learning platforms. Would those learning platforms be what, in fact, in the past used to be referred to as teaching hospitals? Teaching hospitals. Yeah, okay. That puts me in place, because I belong to that teaching hospitals link. Now, teaching hospitals had to be accredited. They had to be accredited. You couldn't possibly put students who are learning or even interns in non-teaching hospitals. Now, my question is, for instance, the chair there alluded to, you know, the visit and finding young doctors who are battling on their own in places where there doesn't seem to be somebody senior that they can talk to, and there's no teleconference communication also, no facilities for that. Now, is it the case then that in fact we do have doctors, students who are learning, who need to have somebody senior to them, who actually are on their own, which means they are in non-accredited, which would mean that they are in non-accredited the places, those institutions or hospitals or whatever you want to call it. Because from what we are talking and what we seem to see outside there, that seems to be the case, that perhaps there is that. So I just want to be clear on that one.
Can I mention why you are leaving us?
Oh, it's
set my discussion. Okay. Thanks. In fact, I think maybe you should go further, Maltuli, and say, when we mostly see this, it's actually in the rural areas. Those teaching hospitals that are in rural areas, it's where you don't find people that are looking after the young ones. Ndabe Fanara is leaving. Oh, you can switch off your mic. He's leaving because somebody is being sworn in as a member of parliament. The leader of COPE is being sworn in. Now we'll see the two leaders sitting together today. We'll see them sitting together in parliament. No, the court case has just been finished today. It was so that's why he's being sworn in. The court was today, he's being sworn in today, he's going to be sitting in parliament at 2 o'clock with the other leader. No, I was not creating another debate here. Remember. Okay, it's the whip and then the camera.
Thank you, Chair. We'll be enjoying today sitting at the house. It will be quite an experience. Maybe you won't be able to answer my question today, but if it's possible, you can maybe forward it to us. I would like to have a breakdown of the 150,000 healthcare practitioners. The breakdown, how much is the annual fee, how much do they pay, and what is your projection of the future growth of the health professionals? How do you project? What is your budget? Present budget, more or less, and what is the cost of the oral system? The oral system.
Oral system.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. One time I was taken, I was taken to court by HPSA. That I was not registered, yet I was not working as a doctor. And I'm going to sue SPCSA.
My question is basically a follow up on the previous questions that I've asked. On the issue of the CPD, I concur with you 100%. We need CPD, we need people to be knowledgeable, to have the latest trends, blah, blah, blah. But my issue was actually, maybe let me ask you a further question to say, are you saying all is well in terms of professional bodies that you have, radiography, speech therapy, blah, 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 to say everyone is registered and everyone complies with the 60 CEU units? I'm not sure whether you call it units now or the ways have changed. 60 in 2 years. Are we saying that everybody is okay except the 88 that is non-compliant because of maybe the wrong addresses and all that? Maybe, yeah, just to rephrase my question, are you saying everything is well on that side in terms of registration? And then the other question is on the issue of the delay. The delay is still linked to this one in terms of the wrong addresses and all that. Are you saying on your side you don't have any problems or loopholes, you know, that may cause the delay? The delay is always caused by the practitioner themselves or the professionals in terms of like the wrong address that you admitted and all that. Are you saying all is well on your side, or are you 100%? I mean, if people were giving you the right address and everything within 21 days, or you said 28 days, people get their card. And then the other one, this is just for interest to say, it might not be to you, but you must have an idea, having dealt with a complaint from customers or patients or whoever. I wanted to know the link between the hospital complaint system and your complaint system to say, would you be the next stage after the hospital? The cases that we've dealt with so far, what has been the trend? They started at the hospital or they went straight to you based on the social responsibility activities you've spoken about? And then on the very social responsibility activities you've spoken about, did you test if really the increase is due to those activities or it's due to something else? Because I would say after you've done the activities, you must be able to monitor and evaluate the outcome, right, of the activities. So, for instance, you would have a question to the complainants to say, how did you learn about the rights, you know, pertaining to your complaint? You know, something like that. Have you done anything and
Is that all? Makanya, do you want to say something?
No.
Oh, okay. Great. You want to come and have a second bite? Oh, okay. Like the insurance my way.
Yeah. You know, this question that is linked to doctors who, I won't use the word corrupt, but who misuse their status and powers, has been a problem for some years. For an example, you find that the doctors have been given past the communities letters that they will qualify for grants. Now, to me, that is part of corruption. And doctors have been declaring people dead while they are still alive because of what do you call this, insurance policy. Now, I want to check as to who deals with this type of complaints. And then if it's this department, can just get the breakdown as to at least how many doctors have been strike off the roll because of malpractice of their patients. Number two is that when we talk of community participation or community, how do you do that to contribute towards the community? People have asked a question, but I still want to take it further as to what is it that you are doing in our community, and maybe if you can just specify which communities are you doing whatever it is. And as you register all doctors that are supposed to be mental assessed patients, can you maybe give us a ratio as to, according to you, how do you see patient doctor ratio in South Africa? Do we have enough, or do we still have to seek for more? Or maybe we are clapping ourselves when we say there are no doctors, only to find that most of the doctors are in their smaller than surgeries. And after finding that a doctor has committed crime, how do you monitor that that person will never work in South Africa, whether having his or her own surgery, or maybe going to far rural areas where they are desperate, and you find that the doctor was committed crime and strike of the law, but has still have chances to operate? Yeah, I think let me pause for just a second. The last one, the education to the community. What methodology do you use to inform us as to who you are, where you are, and if we have complaints about doctors, what is it that we can do? Do you go to print media, do you advertise yourself in TVs, or just news?
Okay, thanks, but I want to say one. You know, there are two areas here. There are criminal charges where if I kill somebody or I do something wrong doing my job as a doctor, do it deliberately, then I go to court. And there are some minor things that are done in the profession that are handled by the regulator. I think we need to separate those two things because they are slightly different. It's like in the department, you must steal money from the department working in the department, and that case might be small and it might be handled internally, and you are fired or whatever, or you are given whatever. But if it's so big that it's a criminal case, then you go to court. And it depends on the department to say, if you lose in court, then we're firing you. obviously are fired. So I think it's almost the same thing, but she must ask her. Okay, Manso. Thanks, sir. That was the last, so you can check on friend uncle.
Thank you. I'd like to start with perhaps the questions that I didn't cover in the last session and were repeated in some form or another by the honourable members, both Emma and Mr. Walters. The first issue of the number of letters of good standing, I would not be able to give you that right now, however we can address that formally once we give you the statistic as a complete record is actually kept. However, there's no separation because I think it's very important to note that we are giving a letter of good standing in terms of has there been any charges brought against this doctor? Has there been any complaints brought against this doctor? And that is what we are actually noting and being able to address. In terms of establishing the numbers of doctors leaving South Africa, that would also be fairly difficult to undertake on our register because many doctors maintain their registration in South Africa whilst they are practicing all over the world, and there are a number of doctors who do it for extensive periods. Annually, they pay their fees, but it is not a prerequisite in terms of the registration for them to indicate where they are currently practicing. And I think in that regard, you know, it would be up to us as a regulator as a means of perhaps assisting the Department of Health function to note the outflow of medical practitioners. But perhaps I would like to perhaps state here that it could be an extension of us as a regulator in terms of the statistic. We would just need to undertake a number of activities in terms of re-looking at our form, which is regulated. he likes it, and then perhaps putting something in there to say, where are you currently practicing in South Africa? And I think that as a regulator, we need to, I think it would be helpful for us to do this, to be in a position to supply committees like this with that information. So it will be a proposal going from this engagement with you here and my noting that this would be actually something that we can actually be in a position to provide if practitioners complete that. And we would need to know whether our act, whether we will be conforming in terms of the act insisting that a practitioner furnish us with that information. So I need to state up front that there's a process. We cannot just amend our form to meet the need of this, but we would look at it and definitely hopefully be in a position to be proactive in terms of providing the popular, well, the government as such with that type of a statistic. The second issue is all the questions that you've raised regarding the emergency care. A formal parliamentary question was addressed to us. I'd like to take direction from the chairperson. If this is the platform that I should make a formal statement in that regard, as a formal response, stating many statistics, etc., has been forwarded through to the Minister of Health. So I'd like to get direction from the chair to say, am I able to answer these questions here? Uh-huh. As this formal answer has already gone through to the Minister's office.
Maybe the, you are saying, I want to get you very clearly. You are saying that the question was asked to the minister,
correct,
and you have given a response to the minister.
Correct.
What you are not sure about is whether the minister has said it in parliament,
correct,
in response. I think I would request that we leave it for now, because we are going to get it in parliament in any case from the minister himself.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Waters, all the issues regarding your EMS questions are all embodied in a very hefty document that we have already supplied a formal response to. So I'm going to, under advice, move on from there. I want to touch on the issues raised by the Honourable Member with respect to the operation. Issues such as the delays that were caused. Indeed, we did experience delays with respect, which I indicated in the presentation, of the issuing of practicing cards. This, like any other IT system, when a new system is implemented, there are innumerable difficulties, etc., with respect to the implementation, and there were delays. However, what we did when we knew that we were not able to produce the practicing card due to our system not being able to generate it at that point in time, we notified practitioners. We were proactive in engaging with institutions who, in terms of practitioners being employed by government, to indicate to them, these are the practitioners, they have paid, and we gave a letter of undertaking to state to these practitioners, we do acknowledge receipt, you are within your compliant, and you have paid. However, systemically, we have a problem. However, if you produce this letter on an HPCSA letterhead, this is as proof of you being registered. Until the practicing cards were able to go out, which have all been sent out together with the annual reminders. So we had notices on our email. We were proactive in informing employers that if they have a problem, contact us. The iRegister was part of that problem of the delay, and the practitioners were not able to access it. We have finally been in a position to, as I indicated, the Oracle system is an integrated system, whereby before we had registration standing alone on one side, our legal department on another side, and our professional board. We needed to produce and to give the public an integrated approach. Whereas if you have a complaint against you, it's not a system where we have made errors in the past because of the manual system. where a CLS is produced. In the meanwhile, the legal department's manual way of reporting has not reached the registration department, so a person was issued with a certificate of good standing when in fact they had cases pending against them. And that is the reason why we had to move to an integrated system, whereby now we've got the legal department's record of who has been charged with professional crime coming up the minute that person applies for a CLS. It's flagged to say, you are sitting here with five complaints against your name. And that is what our role is in protecting the public. We constantly have to look at what are we doing operationally to talk to our mandate. We cannot be undertaking an operational activity that's not talking to what is our role and responsibility in terms of doing what we ought to be doing as a regulator. So in terms of that, we are confident now that with this integrated approach, we are definitely in a position to service the practitioners and the population more adequately. Many questions have been raised on CPD. Also, with respect to the chairperson's question, are specialists required to do CPD? Indeed, yes. If you're a medical practitioner, whether you're just a GP, or whether you are a professor at the university with many qualifications, that does not mean that you stagnate. You have to continuously ensure that you are keeping yourself up to date. So you might be this very hotshot professor today. However, have you kept up with the trends internationally? Are you able to deliver the most efficient gynecological service to the women of South Africa today? You might indeed have been the hotshot gyne 12, 15 years ago, but what have you done? Are you using new methodologies to service your clients or to service only your patients? So the aspects of CPD is really a non-negotiable. Issues such as costs that are being incurred, it is incumbent upon the practitioners to gain those points. It has become so easily accessible that you can even gain points just by clicking the button on the internet and undertaking a little research there, and you get 2-3 points. So, you know, we have a special committee, which I indicated, called the CPD Committee. This committee is comprised of persons who sit on each of the professional boards who all come together and in council chooses a objective chairperson who will monitor the activities of all the CPD activities within each of the boards. That's why we have a council committee called the CPD Committee. We've looked at international best practice. Each individual one of those committee representatives from the various professions. The research has been extensive, and for us to ensure that our public gets the best, there has to be a commitment by the professional, not even for what they deliver to the public, but then being able to ensure that they are competent. That the 60 CEUs that are required by some honourable member, it varies for the different professions. I am giving the highest number of 60, which has been required by medical practitioners. For the various professions down the line, the number of CEU requirements differ. So I'm not able to give you of all in excess of 28 or 30 different professions that are hosted. But dependent on the professional, they would know what the requirement is to comply. And we've seen over the years that to comply, it's not that difficult, but there has to be a commitment by the practitioner to want to comply. And it is indeed within the Act that practitioners have to comply. If a random audit is done, and if a practitioner is found to be non-compliant, they would need to address the board in terms of why they are not compliant. In terms of way up. And as a litigator, we're not saying that our role is the nicest role, but that is exactly why we live. We are there to monitor, to ensure the type of the delivery that happens out there. So if there are practical issues that needed to be raised, the practitioners have a voice through the various professional boards. They can engage with the board and say to the board, this is indeed what we have found. And the board will investigate. The committee member who represents CPD on the board will then take the matter up if they can furnish valid reasons why they are not compliant. And they would need to be addressed. But out there, CPD is a non-negotiable chair, and I think it's important for us to realize why it's the non-negotiable as opposed to looking at the difficulties. And practitioners need to know that they have entered into a profession of professional practice. They are not working behind a till dealing with an inanimate object. They are working with people. And that is why, as a regulator, we have to put the demands in place for a professional practice framework. In terms of a very interesting aspect was raised by the Honourable Chair Grace with respect to social grants and declaring people dead. To that end, we had a workshop last year with the South African police in terms, because as the Chair indicated, these are issues on which civil action will need to be undertaken. However, it is also an ethical issue. Where does one draw the line when a doctor feels the need to declare a person dead to get a funeral policy or an insurance policy or such aspects? To that end, we had a workshop with the Department of the IT Book People.
Home Affairs.
Thank you. And we have a collaborative project going with them, whereby they, if they had a suspicion of a particular doctor, or they had a report stating that this person is well alive, because it's quite a complex matter. The minute the person is declared dead, then they have to get another ID book, then they have to be called something else. So it's a very complex matter that needs to be undertaken, and it is not a process within the HPCFA, the Department of Home Affairs process, because it goes further than the ethical behaviour of that doctor who is declaring a person dead. It goes to other issues of home that are residing within the Home Affairs. Suffice to say that we would look at the ethical behaviour of that doctor in undertaking such activities. Community participation and social responsibility was another question that I didn't address in the last round. If I could start by saying that the role of the community representative starts in our professional board. Whilst it was not indicated on the presentation that I gave, present on each professional board is a community representative. What is the role of that community representative sitting in a professional board meeting? The role is for them to come to that professional board. Remember, there are 12 of those boards, to engage with the issues that are actually on the table. You ask the question, how do we address, what are we doing in the rural community? The community representatives that sit on the board actively engage, know what is going on in the healthcare profession, and are able to go back into their communities and are tasked, in fact, to go back to their communities, report, add value, ensure that education and training in terms of the complaints procedure, what it is that we do at the HPCSA, from the grassroots level is undertaken. You then noted on the presentation where we had 9 community representatives then represented again at council level. Those community representatives are appointed by the Department of Health for exactly the same role and function. How relevant are we as a regulator within the various communities? Those 9 representatives that you saw on the council structure, they come, participate at council level, get an understanding of what are the issues. Remember that they are representatives from the various provinces. So that is how we get our footprint out into the rural communities. Because these are the persons who come and sit in at council. Remember, those are sitting at board level. These are different ones that are sitting at council level who are tasked to come and know what is the role of the healthcare regulator. Go back into those communities and feed into those communities. So the way in which we are structured, not only from the board level, but at the next level, from at the council level, is that we go and we get down, and that is how the marketing of the complaints process, but not only the complaints process, the full ambit of the regulator's work is actually rolled out within the HPCSA. So in terms of being able to get our reach, it is not only done from a high level of so-called PR and marketing. We have people sitting on our board, sitting in our council, knowing exactly what goes on and being tasked by the minister to go back and report in the community on the activities. There's just one more thing I would perhaps like to inform the committee on in terms of how do we monitor and what complementary interventions are undertaken by the HPCSA in monitoring the errant behaviour of doctors. Last year, what we found was that because of our backlog, which was alluded to by Mr. Waters, what do we need to do in terms of addressing the backlog? So if I could speak firstly to say that I would need to go back and give you the years and the number of cases for each of the years where the backlog is as a means of breaking down the outstanding maths work that Mr. Waters did for us, indicating that there were 3,000, plus minus 3,000 cases that are still outstanding. That is would be constituted over a number of years. I would be in a position to actually furnish the committee with that exact number of cases year for year. We have cases, according to my recollection, dating back as far back as 1993. And for those, you know, there are various reasons why they are still considered as backlog matters, because some of them are still at the High Court. You would know that the High Court process is indeed perhaps even longer than our process. Matters can take up to 5-6 years. The Besson matter is already being going for in excess of 6-8 years, so it would also constitute those backlog matters. What have we done proactively? What we found was that in many of the civil matters, for example, the issues being reported of the social grant and the declaration of people being dead, which end up being normal civil matters out there, when this doctor gets into the normal judicial system, we find that the prosecutors prosecuting those matters, for example, we had an issue whereby we had contact lens, just to give you a quick example, being sold at a little corner store. Now, protection of the population's eyesight, there was a trend recently where colored lenses were fashionable. And we had youngsters wearing contact lenses as a fashion accessory. matter then got into a civil case whereby the prosecutor who prosecuted that matter was not aware of the regulator's role and what needed to be undertaken in terms of an ordinary person in the street selling a healthcare product or a pharmaceutical product, etc. So it ended up that case being thrown out. And we took a proactive approach with that. To that end, we went to the National Prosecuting Authority. The outcome of it was that, if I just give you quickly, the outcome was that a task team was formed and now, in fact, a complete special investigative unit has been formed out of that proactive process of us saying that, what is our mandate? We've got to protect the public. Are youngsters' eyes being protected, whereas an issue like that goes into the public domain and we have our normal judicial system not being able to or equipped to handle such a situation? So we sit with the situation where we have to work with our normal judicial system and in now with the NPA. And to that end, we've made great strides in ensuring that prosecutors who prosecute matters like that are equipped with our Act, they've been workshopped on our Act, they know the parameters of what can and can't be done by practitioners out there and the general public in terms of acting upon the public out there.
Mayor, you've got only 3 minutes to round up.
I think an important thing which Dr. Latuli mentioned, which I feel I need to just touch on again really quickly, is the learning platform. There was a question asked as, firstly, what is the relationship between the hospital complaint system and our complaint system, and also the teaching hospital? Our complaint system is very specific. We have to address the practitioners. We regulate the professionals within the hospital environment. There are many issues of quality of healthcare, which the National Department of Health has embarked on a whole new directorate, in fact, the quality directorate, which is going to be engaging to try and overcome issues such as the death of babies, etc., etc., because as the Chair alluded to today, it's complicated. It's not just the practitioners. It's the practitioners, the environment they need to work, the rules pertaining to the whole healthcare environment, and not just the practitioners, whilst there are various areas where jurisdiction comes into place and who has jurisdiction over what part is the important thing that needs to be ironed out there. In terms of the complaint process, our complaint process is in order to regulate the practitioners. There's no relationship between the two. We follow ours and it's in line with the regulations that we have to do that. In terms of the teaching hospital, I think what has been brought to our attention when we are actually sending our teams out for the accreditation of these learning platforms is that indeed there is a void. The Department of Health is constantly being addressed by us because we are the ETQA in terms of regulating that environment. And in terms of the rural areas, there are indeed challenges which we are constantly bringing to the attention of the Department of Health, indicating clearly to them that we cannot have a situation where we have a learner not being guided by a competent professional. And that has been brought to the attention, and in many instances, we remove the accreditation of that learning environment. And that is the right that we have as the accreditation body of that institution. We strip them of that right, and no learners. Once it is brought to our attention, no further learners within the healthy environment are sent there for the experiential learning. We do have the right to strip the accreditation, and we do that very regularly in the course of the emergency. Just one thing quickly, our regulations are very clear, chairperson, in that in an emergency, a doctor does have the right to undertake the activity that he needs to. And the way in which doctors can demand and demand the proper control of the situation is that, as per the regulations, if you are a doctor, you are supposed to be carrying your practicing card. So at any stage, if in an emergency when you get there, you are able to whip out of your wallet and say, I am a doctor, here's my practicing card, that covers the aspects of the emergency. I don't believe that a red light is going to be, because you could be walking and taking a walk in the park and your services might be required of you, at which case you should have your practicing card on you to deliver that service.
Why don't we thank you?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, I think one thing that is very clear is that this is one area that we need to oversight. But more than oversighting the HPSA, but we need to know about it ourselves so that we can make sure that when people are treated unethically, we know where to refer them. So that they can be handled at that level. That's why we called her. And in fact, that's why we allowed her to continue talking, even if she was alone, because we wanted her to give us information as to what is going on in that institution. So thank you for your presentation. Thank you very much, members. Thank you, Secretariat. At least I think we're a better person than we were before. And we even know how to oversight you. Next time we'll ask you whether you're still acting, but that's not your problem, it's the departmental problem, and in fact we need to take it up. I'm hoping, Mike, that we'll wait for the response from the minister, and if that response is not good enough, probably we might have to call Gopek, because I thought that it's better we leave it to him to answer that question if it has not been answered there, because that's another public platform. So thank you very much, members. We can go for lunch. We'll be meeting next week, by the way, and I think next week, who are we meeting?
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're meeting Eastern Cape next week. That is not for you, Maureen. We're meeting Eastern Cape, but the only difference when we're meeting Eastern Cape is that we're not going to be alone. The Select Committee for Women, Children, and Disabled, and People with Disabilities, they're going to be part of us because they went to Eastern Cape. And they told me that they were received very well, and they were told what was going on. But when they wanted the actual details in writing as to what happened in the baby death, they never got the response. And they've been sent from one pillar to post, meaning that the information that they were given orally was not good enough, because they don't want to put it down in paper and say, this is what we found. So they will be here with us next week when we're meeting Eastern Cape. So, thank you. By the way, there's another thing that I need to mention here. There's something called BAT, British American Tobacco. They want to invite a few members of the committee to go to Malawi and Canada. Malawi and Canada. I think there's a reason behind choosing those particular countries. But it's something that we'll talk about later on. I'll discuss it with you, because they just phoned me this morning saying that they want to invite the company, but they haven't decided when we're supposed to be going to those places. But they said it's not good enough to go to Canada in December. That's all they said. They said in December it's very cold in Canada, it's snowing, so it's not the right time. But I'm just mentioning. Thank you very much, members. Thank you very much, Maureen.
Thank you very much, Linus, for giving us the opportunity. And I've got a four questions noted down that we will be responding right in due to next Monday. Thank you very much, Linda.
I thought you were going to ask us questions. You can ask us questions if you want to. We will respond.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, members, we'll be getting another card to sign for Umamu's